Welcome to Influential Visions Podcast. Here, we interview futuristic leaders who share their deep industry knowledge and business experience with you, ensuring you have your finger on the pulse and your eyes wide open. In this series about imposter syndrome, our regular host, Nathaniel Schooler, is joined by Kim Adele Platz as they interview leaders from around the world, sharing how they overcame their inner imposter.
Well, I'm really excited today, obviously, because Kim is here. We're interviewing another amazing guest. And Christina Libby is the Chief Science Officer of Hypergiant, the creator of the Floral Heart Projection, an artist and a writer. You do loads of cool stuff, right? But before I push record, you were kind of telling us about how you're recovering, or you have recovered from your brain injury, right?
Yeah, I had a traumatic brain injury in August. It was kite surfing and I fell from 12 feet onto my head, like right near the beach as I was being carried towards the highway. And I thought, oh my gosh, I'm going to fall on the highway and get smushed between cars. So to stop that from happening, I released my kite, fell on my head, and ended up with a concussion that lasted for almost 18 months, which at that point is considered a traumatic brain injury. But Kim and I were talking about this idea of lessons and blessings. And I think about that brain injury, and it was such a massive lesson for me that has produced a really big blessing. So I, before the brain injury, I was just like going so fast, a million miles a minute. I was just like living this life that was really like high flying. I was like jetting off to kite surf at all of these places. I was doing all of this work. But it was pretty empty, right? Like I was successful. I felt really good about the direction of my life, but I also just like didn't feel sort of like a deep sense of connection. And so that happened, and I ended up spending about 3 months in sort of like a personal quarantine where I like couldn't stand light and sound. If someone touched me, I would start crying. I like would have to go to the doctors and ride the subway, and it would be so exhausting I wouldn't be able to work. But during that time period, my brain was like, you need to paint things, buy paints. And when you first have a concussion, and one of my symptoms was a real lack of impulse control. And so I went into an art store and I bought literally $1,000 worth of arts, like paint supplies and canvases and these giant paint brushes, like really giant ones. And I just started being like, I'm going to learn to oil paint. And I had no idea what I was doing. I like didn't like a lesson. I like didn't buy a book. I was just like, I'm just going to figure this thing out. And so I did, right? So I like started doing it, and it was like, I had no mixing mediums. Like literally I was doing a horrible job of oil painting, but it stopped the headaches in my brain, which plagued me constantly. And so it was the only thing that gave me this reprieve. And I really had this moment of realizing that like creative expression fundamentally changed something in the way my brain was working, allowed me to slow down, allowed me to be really reflective. And that made me really sort of like venture into this creative space. And so I like got an art studio and I was doing these enormous canvases. And my mom, I was like sending little shots to my mom because I like didn't talk to anyone except for my mom. And so I was just like, look at these things I'm making. And she was like, I think you need to share them on Instagram. And I was like, oh, I don't know. I'm like not an artist. And my mom was like, just do it. And so I shared some of them and people were so supportive. And they were like, I love these paintings. I really love this work. And I like last maybe used a paintbrush when I was 10, right? So like this wasn't something I was like driving towards. Except for my best friend said it like a few months before the brain injury, I had talked to her about wanting to paint. And so it was really interesting, I think, that I didn't make any time for it. Then I had this injury, then I did it. But then what that means is that come the start of the pandemic, I'm looking around And I've become really much more visually inclined at this point. And I was just like, why aren't there any visual symbols of our loss? Like, why aren't there photos? Why aren't there flowers being put out? Why aren't we not flying our flags at half mast? Like, what is going on? This doesn't make sense. And because I had become like sort of comfortable with this idea that I was like making art, I thought like maybe I can make something because I'm sad. And like maybe this would make other people's lives better. This is now a very long story. But so I was thinking about that. And so I started to make these floral hearts. And I like took, I make about $500 worth of flowers from Trader Joe's. Now that I'm like incredibly self-indulgent in this like art habit, I bought all of these flowers. Trader Joe's was the only place open. I like took them to my apartment and made this floral garland. And I was like, I just want to put it out somewhere so that someone in the world knows that someone cares about them and that my sadness can be sort of like combated with the joy of trying to make someone else's life better. All that. So I did it. I was so scared. I thought I was going to get arrested. I like laid this floral heart out in the street, walked away. But I saw this man run by and he stopped. He turned around, he came back and he knelt down in front of that heart. And I was like, oh, it worked. I wanted to do something to change someone's day and I did it. And I kept making these hearts and making them and making them. And then yesterday, I actually coordinated hundreds of volunteers and we laid 114 of these floral hearts around the US for those that we had lost to COVID. And I am the last possible option of someone to imagine making like a public arts movement in memorial for like a national pandemic catastrophe. Like if you look at my career trajectory, nothing that I have done would ever say I would do that kind of work. And yet it has connected me so deeply to my community. It has brought me so much love. Like I don't feel alone. I feel so proud of the country that I am part of because all of these people have stepped up to provide support and care and like love for the people who are struggling around them. And this only happened because I had that brain injury. If not for that, it would never have felt able to do something like this. And that to me is just like, wow, how shocking the way that our lives can change through trauma and the way that we can sort of step into these roles that, you know, to the point of this podcast about imposter syndrome, 3 years ago, if you'd like told me that I would be considered an artist, like the New York Times would write my name and be like artist Christina Libby, I would have laughed at you. And now here I am, right? And so I think it's this really interesting, that lesson, blessing, framing for thinking about hard moments in our lives, because if you care to investigate the trauma in your life and you care to think of it as an opportunity, I think it can be monumentally transformative.
And I agree. I mean, what an amazing, amazing story. You must be so, so proud. And I think you're right. I think, you know, in moments of trauma, it doesn't feel like it could be a lesson or a blessing. At the point that it happens, and you kind of go, why me? Why now? Why this? It can be so hard. But, you know, I think when you do take that step back and say, what is life giving me? You know, it is giving me, everything that's happened in my life has either been a lesson, a blessing, or both. And actually, now that I can look at it that way and go, what am I supposed to learn? Where am I supposed to go? And I think we shape ourselves in such a bizarre way. So we end up, and this is a lot of where kind of imposter syndrome comes from. Until the age of 7, we don't have a conscious brain. So we only have a subconscious brain. So we take in everything and we create our first I am statement. And then by the time we're 14, we've kind of enforced it. And by 21, we've embedded it. So whatever that I am is kind of going to be what we carry through. So we forget the things we love to do as a child. And then it's only really as we get a bit older that we realize we can challenge those I am statements or a trauma like your your brain injury forces you to challenge some of those I am statements. It's like it's telling you you've got to paint, but actually you were saying you last picked up a paintbrush when you were 10, so you've painted before. So it reminds you of something that where actually you got your joy previously, and allows you to go, well, maybe I can do this. Maybe I don't have to be the whatever badge I've given myself right now. And amazing that you're having such a tremendous impact on the world. You must be really proud.
Yeah, I have two comments. One is so funny. People keep saying you must be so proud, right? And I just feel so like humbled by it all, because when I did it, I made those hearts in a way from disappointment that I looked at the world and I was just like, I am so disappointed at you for not doing more. Like, I am so disappointed that when all of these people are suffering, we are not trying to do more things to show people that we care. Like such disappointment. And then to see people, I think what people lacked was an idea for how to show it, right? Something that was safe, that was socially distanced, that was beautiful. And so in giving an idea to people, and then people stood up and they were like, I'm going to do this. I'm going to raise money. I'm going to bring these hearts to my neighborhood. I'm going to talk about it on local TV. And so I just feel so wrong, right? Like I had such a picture that people weren't doing it, and what people weren't, people just needed a small amount of leadership or even just an idea. And then once they got that, they were like to the races. And I like make these hearts, right? I like make these floral hearts. But I was a florist when I was like 20 for like a year to pay my way through my master's program. You know, I'm not a professional florist. And so watching what professional florists do as well, and just being like, wow, look at someone who's really at that sort of the peak of their artistry is just so interesting and also very humbling when you're like, oh yeah, my thing that I thought was beautiful is like not as beautiful as these other things that people make that are incredibly beautiful. But the thing I could do was push a little idea out and grow enough momentum so that other people could become involved. And that I love. And I also really love what you were talking about the subconscious brain. I used to have a friend who, she would ask the question of like, what did your little kid self want to do? Like when you were a child, and she would always pick, she was like 7 or 8, right? And she would be like, when you were 7 or 8, who did you want to be? And I constantly kind of go back to that question, because I do think so much of who we want to be gets hidden by all of these narratives about the world, right? And then you take that framing and you kind of get lost in the narrative, right? And I think I particularly got caught up in this like tech world, like join a startup, make a bunch of money, blah, 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 blah framing. And I was good at it, right? And I still exist in that world. But I, in the past year, have been asking this question a lot, right? Like sort of what do you do as a 7 or 8? Like what does your little kid self really want? And I started taking Judaism classes. And really like when I was little, I was like a big question asker. Like, who is God? Is God a real thing? Like, why do people do this, right? Like all of these big questions. And religion offers space for contemplation of those questions in a way that we don't have in society. And it kept coming back to a lot of unresolved little kid questions for me, right? Of just like, how do you view the world? What is good? What is bad? And that has really, having to reinvestigate those questions that you ask as a child now as a, I'm going to put adult in quotation marks because I think I'm still working on that part, but having to sort of reinvestigate those questions has changed how I think about the narratives that have spent so long defining my world.
So Would you say that you felt a bit like an imposter until you started with these flowers? Excuse me. And you were led by what happened to you, right? Did you sort of feel like you didn't fit in and you were an imposter in this tech world that, all right, you were very good in, but did you feel that way at all? Or
you're such a great question asker.
Thank you.
Yesterday, when all of this is happening around the US, I had this, I felt extremely happy. But in this very juvenile way of feeling so comfortable, right? And so, yes, I think I had a moment. I was working at Microsoft in a job I loved, and I have a huge, actually, amount of love for Microsoft. But a woman said to me in a meeting, "Christina, we can't just do all of your big creative ideas." And I remember just being like, but they're really good ideas. And what do you mean we just can't do them? And if you guys would just get on board, like, this are really good ideas. And kind of just being like heartbroken in that moment, because I just like couldn't understand why someone would want to rinse and repeat old ideas instead of chasing down and bringing to life big, new, fun, creative, awesome ideas. Not that they're not all awesome to be just but some of them are great. And doing the project yesterday to me was one of those instances in which I have been my whole life someone who has these like big creative ideas, and I want to make them because that brings me a huge amount of joy, right? And so yesterday was such a moment of watching this tiny little idea now stand on its own legs. Like, this idea now exists without me. Like, people are making floral hearts in their schools, and people are making them at home and hanging them on their door, and like as a symbol for their COVID loss and what we have lost. And that to me just felt like, oh, you're doing your thing. Like this is so true to who you are. And I don't feel uncomfortable with it. I don't feel uncomfortable with sort of the title of being called an artist or this. I don't even know the right word for this thing that I'm doing, but that was a very long answer to your question, except for just to use those points to illustrate the story, because I think so many of us, we do a thing that we're good at, but maybe we don't often take the chance to do the thing. I don't know if meant to do is the right word, but like people use a lot of phrases like stand in your truth or your authentic self. And those don't quite ring with me because it just doesn't quite ring with me. But yesterday was a real moment of understanding that the happiest or sort of most fulfilled I'll be in my life is when I actually like heed that call of doing like the act, like, right? Like I almost wonder if we don't have jobs, but we have like characteristics, right? Or right, like I don't know how to, I don't know, maybe Kim you have some sort of thinking on that.
No, I love it, because I think, you know, one of the things I talk to people about a lot is we often talk about being afraid of our darkness. We were afraid that we might get things wrong, and yet the thing that fears us most is our light. We fear that we might actually be really good at something, and that feels egotistical, and ego, we keep being told, is a bad thing. But actually, we all have a natural talent, whatever that natural talent is. And when we are using our natural talent, and it sounds, you know, from our conversation and just chatting to you, that your natural talent is creativity. It's about thinking about the art of the possible, of being passionately curious about what could come next and being part of that. And that's your light. That's where you, when you step into your light, you get that sense of joy. You get that sense of, actually, I'm not uncomfortable with these labels that people are giving me, because actually I get my fulfillment from it. And I think that's been one of the things, certainly with the people I deal with over the years, it's helping them realize that actually it's because you deep down know that you could be good at this. And that little inner imposter goes, don't be such an ego. What do you know? What do you think? And it's because it's our scared inner child. It's our, you know, it's our smaller self that is doing its best to keep us safe, to stop us from getting hurt. But actually, you know, what it really needs us to do now is reach in and go, it's all right, I've got this. You know, I'm the adult that you were waiting for. And I guess, for me, my little girl's 4.5, and it's been such a breakthrough moment, because I suddenly realized once that the voice we talk to ourselves becomes the voice we teach our children to talk to themselves. And it stopped my heart, because I have been very, very unkind to myself over the years. And I was like, I will not let that be the voice that she teaches herself. And I remember writing this quote, and I wrote it for her, but I believe it to be true of everybody, which is to be kind, to stay curious, and to believe, because you're proof that miracles happen. We are all proof that miracles happen to somebody. And as long as we're curious and we are kind, then actually we should just go and take our little kid by the hand and say, let's go and do the thing that brings us joy. Because I think we're here to do the thing that makes our soul sing. And it sounds like you're finding the thing that makes your soul sing. And just look at the light that then shines on the world.
Oh my gosh. Well, that's like the most wonderful thing I've ever heard anyone say. But I think you're so right. So I really am obsessed with this idea of light versus light. So there is this I think she's an astrophysicist, and I'm going to get it wrong, Sarah Seeger, she's out of MIT. She wrote this book, which I'm going to get the name of wrong as well, but hopefully you can link it to it in the podcast. But she lost her husband, and she is also the person who looks for exoplanets in the solar system, right? So she spends her whole sort of time looking at light. But she did this really wonderful podcast that I was listening to, where she was talking about the universe. And the hardest thing is actually this idea that sort of light is at war with each other, right? And I think we see this in society where, you know, from an ideas perspective, is constantly this war of people who think that they have the right ideas and sort of pushing it out there. And it's very rarely the person who knows they're bad, who's like, who's really taking a step in the world, right? Like, that person wants to live in the shadows. And so it is this idea that, like, there are lots of different people who think they are doing the right thing sort of in this battle of light. But I think for me, it is this idea of, like, sort of stepping into what you are good at and, like, taking that voice away, like, is the force that the world needs, right? Like, we need the more and more people who just sort of stand up and are given space to do what you are capable of. And, like, that's what so astounded me yesterday, is all of these people who became these sort of beacons in their community, who really were, like, this one woman sent us a note, and she was in Maine, and she was a florist, and she was creating one of these floral hearts. And another woman reached out to her and said, my sister-in-law died. We never got to see her. We never got to see her ashes. Like, we haven't even been to Maine since the pandemic. And she said, will you make another wreath, another floral heart for us? And will you lay that in her honor? This is her funeral. Like, yesterday, this heart, that is her funeral. And the florist who wrote to me, or who wrote to our volunteer there, who shared it with me, said, you are giving me a chance to change people's lives. Thank you. This is why I come to work every day, right? And I think deep down at our core, we want to be part of this community existence, right? Like, we want to know that, like, if we step out and we do our great thing, we will be in concert with other people doing their great things, and these people will support us and lift us up. But I believe so much sort of in the last sort of 20 to 40 years, and I blame this a huge amount on the technology industry, we've become so individualistic in our pursuits, and that we don't believe in community. Like, we don't believe it's there, right? So we feel like we have to be this sort of individual greatness, which means that we kind of have to believe the dark stuff, right? And I think that holds us back. And I think if we sort of re-up on community, right? Like, on this idea that people are there to support you and they do want to see you shine and they do want to be part of this experience of, like, people really doing the fulfilling things that they're part of, that, like, that is the world we want to live in. We've just sort of forgotten how to get there. But what you just said about, like, being your own adult for the little kid fears inside of you, that concept to me is just, like, so transformative. Yeah.
Oh, bless you. Thank you. Because I think it is, it's one of those that, you know, I'm very, very fortunate. My little girl, bless her, is poor soul. She's my mini me. So she looks exactly like I did at 4 and a half. So it's a really great way for me being able to
teach adorable.
My inner child, because my inner child's outside running around. And I look at her and go, what would I say to her? You know, what would I say to her if she were given an opportunity? And as a biased mum, I believe as long as she's kind and she tries hard, go for it, sweetheart. There's nothing in the world you can't do if you try. But I think you're right. I think we've fought as a world to find diversity and inclusion, and yet we struggle so hard. And yet at our base, I think as human beings, we want to be listened to, we want to be understood, and we want to be respected. That doesn't mean to say we can't disagree, but we just don't disrespect. And I think if we can hold the space where we seek to understand the other person's perspective, where they're coming from, then actually it becomes a lot easier for us to co-create and for us to go, actually, just because I'm right doesn't make you wrong. And just because you're right doesn't make me wrong. We're just viewing things from a different perspective. And actually, collectively, we will be stronger. The sum of the parts is always greater. Mm-hmm. And I think that for me, that, you know, visualizing things, so being creative, pictures, floral arrangements, artwork, and also stories, you know, the one thing that connects us all, irrelevant of our age, our race, our culture, our religion, is that we all teach and learn through stories. And we've been doing it since the caveman drawings, we've been doing it since the hieroglyphics. So you can see that actually people just want to see that brought to life because they can see how that translates to them in their world, their language, what's going on for them. And I think that's why things like what you're doing really help us to bridge the communication gap, because I think a lot of our challenge is down to misunderstanding, misinformation or miscommunication. And if we can address those, then we get to create the co-creative society that I think is the one we're supposed to have.
I couldn't agree with you more. I've spent a huge amount of time because I started in sort of this like Judaism exploration, and then it really has taken me in this deep exploration actually into religion in our lives. So much so that I'm considering going to divinity school, not to become clerical. And I have a lot of questions about religion, but more because I think religious stories are foundational and fundamental to our social stories, right? And because of that religious investigation work, I spent a lot of time trying to think about like emotional health of a community on a society, right? And so often we think about sort of individual well-being, but this grief work that I've been doing, this COVID work, I've been hosting these vigils, talking to everyone in the community, sort of exploring. And I think the American social situation is a particularly interesting one because I think it is so fraught. But I actually really deeply believe that the emotion that is underlying so much of that division is actually grief. Like, I think it is like compounded collective historical grief. And until we can attack that sort of emotional underpinning, which is extremely hard, right? It's extremely hard to do. But until we can tackle that, I think all of these efforts around things like diversity and inclusion, around women's rights, around community well-being, they're just unable to truly fix the society, right? Like it, yeah. Until we excavate that, our actual darkness, right? Sort of looking at the things we have historically done wrong, the things we have tried to just like sweep under the blanket, right? Yeah. Slavery, and any of the wars we have been part of, like the sort of way we have orchestrated our society. In the US, we just don't talk about things, right? Like cancel culture is such a part of this. Of just like, we're going to cut this person out of our community. That doesn't make your community healthy. That makes a bunch of people outside now who are fundamentally unhappy about the state of the community, who are going to be really angry and not work in community, right? And so that's like what we need, and I've spent a huge amount of time thinking about this, is actually like, how do you emotionally reconcile a society so that you can start to do these things that are actually like diversity and inclusion efforts won't work if people are still so much holding on to the grief that they have over what they have lost. And so how do you do that? Like, how do you navigate that? Because I think that fear, that like social heaviness that we are carrying stops each one of us from stepping into our light, right? I mean, I almost did with this Floral Heart Project. I made a heart for Black Lives Matter and I got so torn apart for it. And it was coming from such a place of like, just like solidarity. And I was so confused, right? Like what, how, where the, like where all of the anger was, that I almost stopped doing the whole project, right? And I was like, but what I very did clearly learn was that it's like, I like created a swim lane, right? I was like, I guess this project is only about COVID and it's only about COVID loss. It is not about our larger loss. But even when I started the project, people were just like, I don't like this. And I was like, okay. And, you know, and people were really unsupportive and I just kept doing it anyway. But I think about yesterday and I think about if I had let all of those other people's emotions and their point of view and their anger stop this, then I wouldn't have had this like beautiful, really meaningful moment yesterday, right? And so, and I think it is that process that has forced me to really be like, what is happening? Like, what is happening here? Like,
I'll
like,
tell why? You. Let me tell you.
Yeah.
I think it's a lack of encouragement in society. And so what we're doing is we're in effect, we're creating more people that have imposter syndrome and have self-confidence problems because we're not encouraging them to go and live with their purpose. Because, you know, and everyone worries about purpose. Oh, my purpose, what's your purpose? Oh, I don't know, I need to be like Sinek, you know, I need a purpose, right? And it's like, everyone is obsessed with this massive purpose that they have to have, right? When actually your purpose right now might just be to put a heart on the grave or somewhere, right? And then that is going to spread into something even bigger than you and everybody else, right? But like, it's a lack of encouragement, and that's what I think.
I think that's so interesting because I think that's all, like that is all that this whole community of people that I worked with needed, was just a little bit encouragement to go out there and create these safe spaces for other people. And I think, I mean, when you, and I mean, I am so US focused right now, but like when you look at US politics and there is no encouragement, there is all division, right? And so that kind of sort of leader who, or more and more leaders, finding so many leaders who are like really good parents, right? Like really encouraging of like, go out there, like make this thing, like leave, like, you know, lead with love and kindness. And I think Kim, what you said was so powerful, which is just like, if you're doing it out of compassion and you try hard, like that's, I think that gets you so far. I think like educated compassion, right? But I think that's really powerful, that idea of like, maybe we just need more encouragement.
Well, I think it's true. And it's funny, I talk about this all the time. So not bless you, you've said this numerous times, but it's like you look at it and say, if I said to you tomorrow morning when you wake up, you're going to have to learn how to walk or talk or run or jump or skip or dance, you'd be overwhelmed. We'd all be overwhelmed. And I know obviously you've had to do some of that with your concussion. But the reality is, at our most vulnerable, at the point that we are, we're unable of doing anything else without the help of other people, we learn how to do it. As babies, at our most vulnerable, when we look to other people, we learn how to walk, to talk, to run, to jump, to skip. And I was like looking at my little girl and going, God, we're amazing people, really. When you think about all these things that we do, and not just her, you know, the world in general. But it really got me thinking, okay, what is it that's different about us then to where we are now? And it comes down to three things. The first, we just wanted to be like everybody else. So you're all walking, talking, running, jumping, skipping, and I just want to be like you, because actually we don't want to be different. We crave that conformity. The second one is, I don't actually really know how to say no and mean it. I'm too young. And the third one is, and for anybody that's ever seen children learning to walk, that hopefully this resonates. The minute that a child is trying to walk, everybody around them is there going, come on, sweetheart, you're nearly there. You can do this. So we absolutely lend them our belief. We lend them our belief that they've got it, that they can do this, and that we are going to catch them if they fall. And it's the thing that we take away as adults. And I think if we can get ourselves back into a place where we lead in that way, where we lead in the way that says we're going to lend people our belief that we can have a better future and that they can be part of it. And to your point yesterday, you can create that safe space and see the impact that had. There was a safe space. You shared your belief that they could do this, and then they stepped up and did it. And if we did more of that, you know, imagine the ripples that would have in the world.
Yeah, about the project yesterday, just to keep using this as an example, is I had one volunteer in Chicago reach out and just say, I felt so alone before this. Thank you for creating a community where I could celebrate the loss of my parents, where I could spread love and connection. And it was just through sort of that act of encouragement. And I think back to the point about imposter syndrome, which I also think is so powerful. I wrote a piece about imposter syndrome for Adobe's 99U earlier this year. And I hate imposter syndrome. Like, I sort of like hate the concept at all, because I think we have taught so many people to be imposters, right? That then they wind up at, you know, the top of their field, just being like, what are we doing here? I don't want to do this work. I don't like this work. I just sort of like towed the line to get all the way here. And so what does that, I think what that means is that we have so many people at the top who should be grown-ups, right? Who should be encouraging us, but who feel so unclear of how they even got there or what they are doing there or why they are there, that they feel almost incapable of encouragement, right? Because they don't feel like they should be there. Like they don't, like they are in a top, they like, I secretly think at least probably 50% of the people who are sort of like up at the top of places doing things feel that way, and so that they feel really unable to encourage people.
It's so true. I mean, they say 70% of us suffer from imposter syndrome at some point, and actually Einstein had it. So he has a quote which says, the esteem within which my work is held leaves me feeling like an unlikely swindler. So even somebody who is globally recognized as a genius doubted themselves. And I wonder if sometimes it's the label we use. So we say it's imposter syndrome, and that feels awful, doesn't it? I'm an imposter, I'm a fraud, I'm all these sub-labels that come from it. And I wonder if instead it's actually the symptom of being an insecure overachiever, because you don't really feel it until you don't know why you got something you got. Like, kind of like, they're going to take this away from me. So they're going to realize that I shouldn't have this, that I'm not sure why I'm here. And I wonder if we could change the label, change the narrative. Could we change the impact that that has?
That is really powerful, right? How much of it is insecurity. And that goes back to essentially what you talked about, right? Which is this like darkness versus light of how many of us are just sort of feeding our own darkness in pursuit of whatever that huge achievement is, you know, and then constantly feeling like, oh, it's not enough. How do we get more? And I think there's a little bit about insecurity that's good, right? Because I think it pushes some of us to sort of like extreme levels of achievement, which is, you know, really lauded socially. But I also kind of wonder about, you know, how do we change, like, how do we change that, right? Like, how do we, and I do think it is, so much of it is narrative, but that idea of also so many people who are doing like jobs, right? Who are sort of, to your point about that, like 14 to, you know, at 14, you sort of are like, I am this. And at 21, I am this often becomes like, I am whatever this job title is, right? Mm-hmm. And I had this wonderful conversation with this man, Rabbi Kula, who is a sort of Jewish activist and thinker. And he was talking about how the work that a functioning society needs never changes, right? And we were talking specifically in a religious context, but I think it applies to everything, which is like, fewer and fewer people are going to religious institutions where they ask these big questions about what does it mean to be human. But that doesn't mean that those questions aren't central to our lives. And so, well, church leadership, those job functions are diminishing because church experiences are not as meeting as many people's needs as they used to. People still need to do the work of church leaders. It just has to be done in a different way, right? And so he used the term where the word rabbi actually wasn't even used for like the first 800 years, I think, of Judaism, that it sort of is a term that evolved out of the Jewish community, and that these people took on these roles as teachers and then religious leaders. And it's sort of an interesting thing about like socially, like how we title the work we do as individuals, and like how do you change that, right? So that, do we give people in society different terms to define them? You know, like, yeah. If I called you like an advocate for the light, right? That sort of means that you are like, that kind of describes what you're doing without giving your job title, which then gives you so much room to explore so many other things than work, right? Like, I think that concept is interesting.
I completely agree. Honestly, I could chat to you all day because it's just so insightful. And I think we have to be able to ask the big questions, don't we? And I think what I love is that it's when you meet people that you know, likewise, are just passionately curious, that just want to learn more, that haven't got a preconceived outcome in mind. It's just a case of, I just want to know what I don't know. I'm going to take, you know, my nan used to say every day is a school day, and she's right. You know, you learn something every day. And I think if you attack life that way, then actually you'll never go far wrong, will you? Because you can see the good in everything. There will be something positive to take away from every experience.
My the man I work for, Hypergiant Ben, he calls the term child brain, which I think is, I find myself just so drawn to people with child brain, right? Like, I just find it so joyful, right? Like, there's just like so much, I think, positivity in living that way. And I think when you are someone who has that sort of curious child brain, people glom on to that, right? Because it is like a little kid thing where we still have a lot of questions. Like, you know, what is life like on Mars? What would we do there? Where will we live? And I think so many people are like afraid to have those questions about that when I think that is like an elemental part of being human, actually, to like have that sort of playful investigation. But we just, I think we get taught that like having the right answers is what makes you a good grown up, right? So then you learn the right answers and you assume that, that like that is the thing. But I think that feels so cold and yeah. and empty. I used to date this man who would always like quote, he could like quote anyone. He would be like, blah, 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 as Charles Dickens said. And I was just like, what is going on? Like, I like can't remember those things, but he felt so uncomfortable writing his own words, right? And that to me seemed like such a story for our society, which is how many of us feel comfortable sort of like mimicking the words of grace, but are so uncomfortable feeling okay sharing the thoughts and ideas that are in our own brains.
There's too much information. This is the problem. Overrun with information. And it's just, it's a disease. Everyone thinks they need to do this and that. And okay, it's fine for some people if what they're doing isn't working, right? They clearly need to go and investigate it and, you know, correct it, right? But like, I don't know. I think it's a funny world, really. It's always a school day, that's for sure.
Oh, it's such a good, there's one other thing this makes me think of. I was recently listening to this podcast called Ministry of Ideas, which I love, highly recommend. I think you both would deeply enjoy it. Although not clearly, obviously not the best podcast on the internet.
Of course not.
But they did a wonderful episode about the technology industry and our obsession with efficiency, right? How we are like so obsessed with like the most efficient weight loss plan, the most efficient means of getting information from one place to the other, et cetera, et cetera. What's so interesting is that efficiency was correlated with godliness, right? God was this like really efficient creator of human society and ideas and et cetera. And so we end up in this world where we have assumed efficiency is godly, right? And so like we have this inherent inner secret story we don't really talk about, which is this corollary between, oh, I want to be more efficient. I want to be like assuming that the more we do that, the more good we will be, right? And actually, it is just a narrative, right? And it is like filling our lives with this desire that is I think fundamentally at odds with what actually really fills our lives. And so to your point, right, which is that there's too much information. We are sort of sorting through all of this information. We are trying to be like really efficient about where we find it and how we store it. And our brains are doing that, right? And so they're becoming these like hyper-focused little information nugget machines instead of having time to relax and create and think and even explore who we really want to be relative to the narratives that we're told, right? And I think that is like such a huge challenge for anyone who is struggling with this idea of imposter syndrome or who they want to be or how they want to be, which is like how finding time to break down your own narratives and then sift through all of the information in the least efficient way as possible, because that's really the only good way to do it, and then build it back up into something totally amorphous that can enter all of these different ways of living and grow from there is hard, really, really hard.
Mic drop. She nailed it, right, Kim? What can we say to that? Like, that's completely what we're doing here, right? We want people to go over all of their statements, what the hell they're telling themselves, and then rebuild themselves back to what they should be and where they want to go, right? And that's in essence what we're trying to do here, right?
Yeah, it's getting people to realize that actually we're so busy we're so busy learning and hiding simultaneously. We live in a despair and compare society, and we put up these pictures of ourselves on social media. Funnily enough, never the no makeup selfie when you've been up all night with your toddler, or the fact you burnt dinner because you weren't paying attention because I was playing Barbies. But those things happen. You know, that is my reality. That is my world. And so we look at these things and we see people's seemingly perfect lives, and we see the mess of our own lives, and we find ourselves lacking. But all of it comes from what we're telling ourselves, the labels that we've put on ourselves, and this fear that we can't change them, and yet we can. We can go back. But you're right, Christina, it's hard, and it's ugly, and it's uncomfortable, and it gets you sad. But it gets you sad for a period until you realise that you've now are able to grieve for what you did to yourself, and then you can rebuild. What do you now want it to be? What's the other evidence? Because we can change anything that happens in our life if we're willing to go and do the work. But it's about, how do we find enough safe spaces to hold people's hands while they do that? Because what they don't want to have to do is do it on their own, because it is hard to go back and look at the things that didn't go well in your life and forgive yourself your part in them. Because you have to recognize that you were part of it. You were the constant. And that can be the hardest thing, is to realize that actually you are the thing that got in your way and continue to do so. But I think, you know, if we can help people to understand that it's okay, it doesn't matter what happened in our past, it made us who we are, and it's giving us a lesson. We've just got to go and learn the lesson. And then we can free ourselves from that and have the future that we want. And I think you've absolutely nailed it.
Yeah, thank you, Christina. It's been an absolute joy. And so if people want to find you, I'll drop a link somewhere and they can find you, right? That's the best thing.
Yes, yeah, at ChristinaLibby.com probably is the easiest place
to start. Cool. And thank you, Kim. It's been a joy, as always.
It's been a delight.
Thanks so much for supporting our show. Please do share this episode with your friends and business associates, and click the link below to subscribe to the podcast. Until next time, take care.